Imagine an event that brings hundreds of members of Congress from both chambers and parties together for an evening to learn about and revel in American history. Not only is it true, it's happened more than 38 times over the past 6 years. In 2013, David Rubenstein, philanthropist and co-founder of the Carlyle Group, approached the Librarian of Congress with an idea for an event series in which members of Congress could put politics aside and immerse themselves in the history of the nation. Thereafter began the Congressional Dialogue Series, a dinner event held several times a year during which historic artifacts are exhibited, and Rubenstein interviews best-selling and award-winning authors and historians for a congressional audience. Now, in David Rubenstein's new book, The American Story, Conversations with Master Historians, these compelling conversations with the biggest names in American history are presented for all to learn and for all to enjoy. It's a great pleasure to welcome David Rubenstein to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us, sir. Great pleasure.
My pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Again, the name of the book is The American Story, Conversations with Master Historians. So how does one, the leader of one of the most successful private equity firms become really doing my job of being an interviewer?
Well, I'm not doing it as well as you do it.
You don't know that yet.
I became the president of the Economic Club of Washington. I was supposed to bring speakers in, and I found the speakers were a little boring, so I started to interview them, and I would intersperse humor with some of the serious questions. People seemed to like it. Bloomberg then gave me a TV show to do it. But in this particular case, what I like to do is ask people about history. I am an advocate of people learning more about history. In our country, sadly, we don't know much about history anymore. We don't teach American history very much. You can graduate from any college in this country without having to take an American history course. And you can be a history major in any college in our country without having to take an American history course in most colleges. So we don't know things like we should know them. For example, 3/4 of Americans in a recent survey could not name the 3 branches of our government. And 1/3 of Americans cannot even name 1 branch of government. 10% of American college graduates think that Judge Judy is a member of the United States Supreme Court, which is not the case.
So I'm sorry, what was the percentage?
We can educate people. 10% of American college graduates think that Judge Judy is a member of the United States Supreme Court.
Even more amazingly,
16% of all Americans in a recent survey said that Justice Scalia was the Chief Justice of the United States. He's not even alive anymore.
Right.
So it's a sad situation. And as a result, you find that Americans are probably not as informed about what their government is doing as they should be. So I'm not going to be able to fix all of that. I have tried to do something I call patriotic philanthropy, which is to say buying historic documents, putting them on display like the Magna Carta, the Declaration of Independence, or fixing things like the Washington Monument or Monticello or the Lincoln Memorial. But that's a modest thing compared to what needs to be done. This book is probably modest in some respects as well. I thought that who better to know about American history than the people who are making our laws? So once a month, for the last 6 years or so, I have gathered members of Congress. We get 200 to 300 people attending these dinners. I interview a great historian, and members of Congress, they ask their questions. They get the they bring their dog-eared copies of the books they've already read and want them autographed just like anybody else would. And it's a modest contribution to thinking that people can learn more about history. And members of Congress actually do this in a civil way. Democrats are asked to sit with Republicans, and people get along with each other. You wouldn't realize what's actually going on in the other parts of Washington. But for that two-hour evening, that two-hour period of time, people do get along well.
It is an amazing list of people that you include. Jack Warren, David McCullough, John Meacham, Ron Chernow, Walter Isaacson, Cokie Roberts, Doris Kearns Goodwin, Scott Berg, Jay Winnick, Jean Embert Smith, Richard Reeves, Taylor Branch, Robert Caro, Bob Woodward, H.W. Brands, and Chief Justice John Roberts. So the list is incredible, and I assume given your prestige, but also given the fact that you're doing this for Congress, that you can attract these names to talk, given the mission being able to do what you do.
I think most people who write books want people to read those books. and they want to be read by, have them read by influential people. So who could be more influential than members of Congress? So it's not that difficult to attract people to this program now that it's established. It's easier than it was at the beginning. And members of Congress want to come because they like an enjoyable dinner. They get to meet with people from the opposite party, which they rarely do, and they get to hear firsthand from a great historian. So it works out quite well. Nothing is going to overnight change the problems in Washington, but this is a modest way of saying to members of Congress, maybe we could get along a little bit better than we are.
It is so interesting that in the people included in this book, some are gone now, and it really is quite lovely to read what they have to say and understand their great contributions to history and understanding this country's history.
One of those who's passed away is Cokie Roberts.
Right.
She died at the age of 75 of breast cancer a few months ago. But before she did, I interviewed her about three of her books. She wrote three wonderful books about American women's role in history. And as we call it, it's history, his story. That's because men are often writing books about men. But she wrote a book about women and the women who influenced our country and who aren't that well known. And it's a terrific eye-opening look at the influence that women had in the early days in our country when they not only couldn't vote, they couldn't hold office, they weren't even allowed to own property in their own name.
When you think of what you want to do next, so what does the wish list for David Rubenstein look like?
Well, my greatest wish list is to live long. I'm 70 years old, an age that I once thought was a retirement age, but I'm doing what I call sprinting to the finish line. I want to get as many things done before my brain or my body collapses, and you never know which is going to go first. I am trying to give away all of my money. I signed the giving pledge. I was one of the original signers, and you're supposed to give away half your money, but I'm in the process of trying to give it all away. And I try to do that in money areas, but one of them is patriotic philanthropy, reminding people of the history and heritage of our country.
So define patriotic philanthropy for me. How does that work? What does that look
what
like?
What I mean is this. All philanthropy is patriotic in some respects, but I use that phrase. I'm trying to say to people, these are things which the federal government doesn't really have the money or inclination to do, but which can be done and which can remind people of the history and heritage of our country. So, for example, when I buy rare copies of the Declaration of Independence, I put them on display in place that people will see them, and they can learn a little bit more about the history of the country by seeing those documents. And the reason I say that is that the human brain has not yet evolved such that if you see something on a computer slide, it's the same as seeing it in person. So if you go to see at the Smithsonian, for example, an original copy of the Declaration of Independence, before you go or after you go, you're probably going to learn more about it, read more about it, and maybe learn more about our country's history. And so that's what I mean by patriotic philanthropy. Or when I go to Monticello and I thought it needed to be rehabilitated a bit, I offered to put up the money, but I wanted the slave quarters to be built out there so that the people that visit will recognize that for all of his virtues, Thomas Jefferson was, like many of our early founding fathers, a slave owner.
Let's go through some of the interviews. We won't be able to get to all, of course, but I just want to touch on a few of the highlights. One of my favorite humans on this planet is David McCullough. You talked to him in the book about John Adams. Of course, he was the author of a beautiful book on John Adams, published in 2001. But you also touch on President Truman in that discussion as well.
Yes. John Adams was not as well known as other founding fathers because I guess he didn't have a famous book written about him until David McCullough came along. And there's actually no monument or memorial to John Adams in Washington, D.C., even though John Adams was our first vice president and our second president. And David McCullough brought him back to life. That book is now probably in its 80th printing. And it resonated with people because this was a man who was really more responsible for our revolution than any other single human. He was the person who got the Continental Congress to really vote in favor of breaking ties with England. But he wasn't that well known. And in that book, in that interview, I also talked about another person who wasn't that well known in recent years, Harry Truman. And his reputation has been restored a bit because of the great biography also that won the Pulitzer Prize by David McCullough. And David McCullough is a person who writes in a very unusual way. He writes his books, and every time he writes a paragraph or two or three paragraphs, he gives it to his wife of 65 years, Rosalie, to read back to him so he can hear how it sounds. And so when he was writing the John Adams book, she read back to him everything that he wrote. One time she read a sentence back to him, and he said, it sounds okay. She said, no, that sentence doesn't work. He said, read it again. And she read it again. He said, no, it's okay. She said, no, it really doesn't work. It's not a good sentence. He said, it is. Let's just go forward. So the book came out. It won the Pulitzer Prize. The reviews were spectacular. One reviewer said, this is one of the greatest books I've ever read, except how could a writer like David McCullough write this terrible sentence that he wrote? And he had that one sentence that Rosalie McCullough had thought shouldn't be in there.
Having met her, she is quite a force, isn't she? That is lovely. And this gives you an idea, too, I find, before we leave David McCullough, of just the role of a historian to bring people like that to John Adams. We think we know John Adams. We think we know Harry Truman, and to write an 800, 900 page book, and just to learn so much about him. That Truman book was just, it changed
well,
me.
Well, remember when Harry Truman left the White House, he carried his own suitcase to Union Station. Popularity was less than 15%. At those times, there was no Secret Service protection for former presidents. Took the train back to Independence. The first time he came back to Washington, he drove the car himself. And then when he died, there was no pension for him or his wife. Congress had to pass a pension for his wife of $5,000 a year. It was a different time.
You talked to Walter Isaacson in the book about Benjamin Franklin. Of course, he has written about Kissinger and Einstein and Steve Jobs. And picks geniuses. Certainly, Benjamin Franklin fits into that list. But Benjamin Franklin, in having read Walter Isaacson's book and talked to him about it, Franklin is fascinating because he's a kind of an odd guy.
He is odd. He wasn't elected president of the United States, but he was the most famous person in this country for many years until George Washington came along, idolized by people in Europe where he lived for almost 20 years. Because of his scientific discoveries and inventions as much as for what he did in government. He was a brilliant man, but uneducated, didn't really go to school. He more or less retired from active business when he was in his early 40s, and he had his wife run the Postal Service of the United States and his printing business, and he kind of moved to Europe and lived off the proceeds of those businesses. But he did some extraordinary things, and he was the only person who signed the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution of the United States, and the Treaty of Paris that ended the Revolutionary War. Quite a man.
I want to get back to some of the other people, but I also want to talk about for a moment where you hold the interviews is important too, right?
Okay. Yes. The Library of Congress was originally in the Congress Capitol building, and then in the late 1890s, finally Congress opened, the Congress authorized a separate building, which is now next to the Supreme Court. It opened in about the late 1890s. And it's still the main building of the Library of Congress. It's now called the Jefferson Building. There's one behind it called the Adams Building and one across the street called the Madison Building. The Jefferson Building is this ornate building that was actually built for about $7 million under budget in the late 1890s. When it was rehabbed a few years ago, it cost $200 million to rehabilitate it. But it's an extraordinary resource. And we do these interviews in what's called the Great Hall of the Library of Congress, which I think is maybe the most beautiful setting in Washington, D.C. It's an ornate, great hall with elaborate architecture and interior design, and members of Congress really enjoy being there, as everybody does. And it can be rented by outside groups, and very often they do because it's such a beautiful setting.
Mm. Let's get back to some of the people. And you focus on Charles Lindbergh in the interview with A. Scott Berg, which is also fascinating, not a president, but someone who was a great hero in this country.
Lindbergh, according to Scott Berg, who spent 10 years on this research and authorized, in effect, by the family because they gave him access to the family papers, he won the Pulitzer Prize in 1999 for it, an extraordinary work. And he says that Lindbergh was the most famous person in the history of the planet at the time he landed in Le Bourget in 1927. Why? Because the world was linked electronically for the first time, and so when he landed, everybody knew about it. When Jesus Christ roamed the earth or the Prophet Muhammad roamed the earth, nobody really knew about him except in their geographic area because the world wasn't linked electronically. Lindbergh became so famous that he couldn't really deal with the publicity. His first son was kidnapped and killed, so he moved to Europe, had a complicated life, and when he died at the age of 72, he wanted to be buried in Maui. He was flown back there. He was buried very quickly because he didn't want the press to know where he was buried. When Scott Berg did the research on this, he won the Pulitzer Prize they mentioned, but he got a letter afterwards saying, your book isn't complete. and meet with me. I'll tell you why. And so he met with the person. The person said, well, you didn't put in there that Charles Lindbergh had 7 children with 3 German women out of wedlock, and I'm one of those children. And it turned out that he had a separate life. He had 4 children who lived to adulthood with Anne Morrow Lindbergh. But in Europe, he had these relationships with 3 German women producing 7 children, all of whom I think are alive today.
Wow. You, at the end of that interview, Berg says that I can't think of another human being who has packed as much life into a single lifetime as Charles Lindbergh. And make no mistake about it, this man changed the way we all live to this very day, which certainly says
a
lot.
True, in part because he, at the latter part of his life, he was what's known as a conservationist. In the 70s and 80s, people didn't really focus on conservation as much as he did. So he really, in the 60s, 70s, 80s, became a leading conservationist, and he really felt that he had, in effect, hurt the Earth by opening up the Earth to so many people flying around the world, and maybe he had done some damage to the Earth by having so many people going to so many places and building so many things in places that things hadn't been built before. So he kind of wanted to atone for that a bit, I guess, and he really wanted to preserve life and land in ways that hadn't been in those years.
A. Scott Berg also wrote an amazing biography shortly after the death of Katharine Hepburn, which is really incredible, too.
Yes. He was a 20-year friend of Katharine Hepburn and wrote an extraordinary book, which sold enormous amounts of copies.
Published right after she passed. Also, and we'll probably end here, but this Robert Caro is in the book. And if you think of an historian who's matched with a president, I mean, Caro really has dedicated his life to Lyndon B. Johnson.
He has spent 45 years of his life. He has written 4 volumes about Lyndon Johnson. The 5th is still underway. He's 84 years old. He still writes on an old Smith Corona typewriter, and he has to go get spare parts because they're always breaking down, and they don't make them anymore. The world is waiting to see what he says about Vietnam and Lyndon Johnson, other things about Lyndon Johnson, because the 5th volume is really about the Johnson presidency. The other volumes really deal with the non-presidential things about Lyndon Johnson. So I hope he gets this book done. Everybody hopes he gets it done. He's an extraordinarily detailed researcher and writer.
And it shows of what it, when someone dedicates over 4 decades to a subject, of how much we learn about that individual.
Yes. I mean, I guess everybody probably doesn't want to have somebody spending that much life, so much of their time devoting to their life, because you see the flaws of people. Nobody is perfect, and so many of the flaws of Lyndon Johnson are pointed out in this book. And he was known as Landslide Lyndon because he won his Senate seat with only 48 votes, and now Robert Caro went back and found out that there was voter fraud, because one precinct had 202 people vote, 200 of whom voted in alphabetical order, and they all voted for Lyndon Johnson.
Well, I love this book. It is The American Story, Conversations with Master Historians. It is published by Simon & Schuster. David Rubenstein, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you so much
Thank
for spending
much.
Time with us. Great pleasure.
My pleasure.
Thank you. Again, the name of the book is The American Story, Conversations with Master Historians by David Rubenstein. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.